And we'll begin our Dhamma talk evening as usual, chanting the refuges and the precepts together. And we'll chant the eight precepts because there is one person and maybe there are more, I don't know, but I know of one for sure that is practicing in this retreat with eight precepts. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa arahato sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Panatipata Veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Abrahmacharya veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Musavada veramani sikapadam samadhi ami. Sura meraya maja pamadatana veramini sikapadam samadhi ami. Vikala bojana veramini sikapadam samadhi ami. Nacha gita vadita Visukadasana, Malaganda, Vilepana, Dharana, Mandana, Vipusanatana, Veramani Sikapadam, Samadhi Ami, Uchasayana, Mahasayana, Veramani Sikapadam, Samadhi Ami. Idam me silam magapalanasa pachayo otu. The title of this evening's talk is Practice Here and There. Practice Everywhere. So, here we are coming towards the end of our retreat of what will be a pretty full 5 days of intensive practice here. And soon to be taking yourself and taking your practice out there, wherever there is for you, which might be right where you are right now. At home. Not all of you are at home, but most of you are. And taking your practice out there will actually be, for most of you, will entail a much longer period of intensive practice, with the possibility being wherever you go, wherever you are, there's your us, we come to the end of a retreat, of an intensive retreat time, some of the thoughts and the feelings that we have right now, or maybe not right now, but maybe at some point tomorrow, they aren't so dissimilar maybe to the thoughts and feelings that we maybe came into retreat with. I think for many people, though there's a feeling of excitement and a real readiness to go into an extended period of intensive practice, which I certainly have heard from a great many of you at the very beginning of this retreat, and even sometimes being reiterated along the way of the retreat. Sometimes just before it's time to enter into a retreat, there's might be the feeling that, well, I'm not really quite finished out here. I just need a few more days, well, maybe another week, so that I can get all the things done that need to be done, and then I'll be ready to go into retreat. That might be familiar to you. And it seems that, in fact, some of us have similar thoughts when it's time to come out of a retreat. An excitement, maybe, and a readiness to whatever degree to go into or enter into the larger world. But maybe along with this might be thoughts such as, well, I just like a little more time here in retreat. Maybe a few more days, a couple of weeks. Today I heard, another month would be really good. I'd like that. To do what needs to be done. And then I'll be finished. And then I'll be ready to come out. And then I'll be ready to go back out there and be in the larger life. And sometimes on either end, the going into the retreat and coming out of retreat, there might be some degree of reluctance, maybe a little bit of resistance, maybe rooted in some fear of the seeming unknown or fear of the seeming known, or maybe essentially just simply resistance to change, to ending one way and then entering into another way. For some of us, when we go into retreat, there's an urgency, a real urgency. I just can't wait. I'm just so ready to go into retreat. And then for some people at the other end, they can hardly wait to be done. There's an urgency to get back to regular life. So some of this might be happening for you. You might check in with yourself and see, in fact, if there are some of these kinds of thoughts and feelings brewing, similar conditioned patterns that are happening within your own heart and mind, maybe coming up now, or maybe might come up tomorrow. Maybe they're brewing. You're not aware of them yet, that you experienced when you were preparing to participate in this retreat, or maybe that you felt at the very onset of the retreat. Or maybe your practice, as your practice showed up and changed in various ways, some of these same thoughts and feelings might have come up. And of course, there certainly is the possibility that there's no anxiety in either direction. There wasn't any anxiety entering or coming into the retreat. And certainly the possibility that one might feel a very clear, clean, open readiness and happiness without any particular expectations or worries about just simply moving on to the next thing, the next phase and form that life will take. At a retreat that I taught a number of years ago, one person described coming out of the retreat. She said she felt like she was descending, she said. And she explained that. She said, like in a plane, descending, landing, feeling the force of gravity coming back to earth was her experience. There's a really beautiful piece that was written by the American astronaut Russell Swikart regarding his experience in outer space. And I'd like to share this writing with you from Russell Swikart. You recall staring out there at the spectacle that went before your eyes, because now you're no longer inside something with a window looking out at a picture. Now you're out. You're out there. There are no frames. There are no boundaries. You're really out there, over it, floating, going 25,000 miles per hour, ripping through space, a vacuum, and there's not a sound. There's a silence, the depth of which you've never experienced before, and that silence contrasts so markedly with the scenery, with what you're seeing, and the speed with which you know you're going. That contrast, the mix of those two things, really comes through. And you think about what you're experiencing and why. Do you deserve this fantastic experience? Have you earned it in some way? Are you separated out to be touched by God, to have some special experience here that other people can't have? And you know that the answer to that is no. There's nothing special. There's nothing that you've done that deserves that, that earned that. It's not a special thing for you. And you know very well at that moment, and it comes through to you so powerfully, that you're the sensing element for humans. And you look down and see the surface of that globe that you've lived on all this time. And you know all those people down there. They are like you. They are you. And somehow you represent them when you're up there, a sensing element, that point out on the end. And that's a humbling feeling. It's a feeling that says you have a responsibility. It's not for yourself. The eye that doesn't see, doesn't do justice, does not do justice to the body. That's why it's there. That's why you're out there. And somehow you recognize that you're a piece of this total life. You're out there on that forefront, and you have to bring that back somehow. And that becomes a rather special responsibility. It tells you something about your relationship to this thing we call life. And so that's a change. That's something new. And when you come back, there's a difference in that world now. There's a difference in that relationship between you and that planet, and you and all those other forms of life on that planet, because you've had that kind of experience. It's a difference, and it's so precious. And of course, there certainly is a change about to happen. And there's change happening moment by moment, of course, as you've all certainly felt and seen and known. And so reflecting on the supports that are available to you as we begin now this evening to make this change out of retreat life into the larger world. One change is the pace of life. At least outwardly, life appears and it feels like it moves a lot faster outside of intensive retreat, even with doing a retreat at home. And yet we're supported as we move into the larger world with some understanding from our days of practice on how quickly and how incessantly things change within our own body and mind. How quickly and incessantly things change all around us, even in the slow pace of retreat life at home. This understanding, this wisdom is really a great support and a great protection as we make this change from retreat practice to practice in the world. Reconnecting with a larger world in the day-to-dayness or the moment-to-momentness in the incessant and often fast-paced changes that happen in our daily lives. And you've also had some taste of the impersonality of change with experiences in our concentration practice just arising, changing, and disappearing. You've had some taste that we can't stop change. And even though we might try, we can't hold on to anything. And maybe you've had a taste of how unpleasant and maybe how painful it is to try to cling on to things, experiences. As concentration and mindfulness developed over these days of our retreat practice, you've had some glimpse that whatever it is that we experience in the body or the heart mind, that any of these experiences come together because of myriad causes and conditions. In truth, an unfathomable number of conditions coalescing in that moment. And then it, whatever it is, can change quite quickly or just simply disappear. These tastes, this understanding has a very deep and beneficial effect on how we think about things and how we relate in the world. There's more clarity in relationship to our deepest goals and aspirations and what we choose to do or not to do. And there's more clarity in relationship to the choices we make. More connection and clarity in our relationships to others. More clarity in what's important and appropriate, what's wholesome and truly respectful and truly kind. These tastes, this understanding is a great support and a great protection as we reconnect with the larger world. In retreat, life is pared down. Even in an at-home retreat, it's a life of much more simplicity than most of us have outside of a retreat. So this is certainly another change from here in retreat life to life out there. Life in retreat offers minimal outside distraction, even at home. We sit, we walk, we eat, you do tasks in your abode, your yogi jobs, whatever they might be, at home. We sleep. You've spoken with me every day, maybe spoken with Christina. And every time you've spoken, and we've spoken a little bit with Sangha at the beginning of the retreat, and every time you've spoken, it's just been a little bit of speaking during this 5-day retreat. And you've been supported within this container of simplicity. You've been supported to mindfully pay attention to the breath and to what occurs in the body and the heart and the mind, and been invited to sense, to see, and to know. Is the mind, is the heart opening to, connecting with the breath? Or is it disconnected? Is it separated? With all of this practice and learning bringing us closer to really seeing and knowing what brings suffering and what brings ease, calm, joy, balance, and a sense of well-being. We're learning to recognize and to respect and to care about all of the cycles within our mind, heart, and body. This seeing and knowing is also a great support and a great protection as we begin to connect with a larger world. We all really are so similar, no matter who we are, no matter where and how we live, no matter our culture, our age, our ethnic background, our color, our belief system. Really, we're just variations on themes. We're variations on this theme of being human. And we're all totally, totally interconnected, totally interdependent on this very small planet that we all share. Sila, virtue, living ethically, respectfully, living harmlessly. It wends its way into being the ground of our life quite naturally as our understanding of what brings suffering and what brings ease deepens and blossoms in our heart. As we come to see and know this through our intensive practice, it affects how we communicate, how we use language. It affects our actions and how we think. Seeing into our own heart mind affects and informs the motivation behind the words and the actions that we take out in the world. And some words from the Buddha regarding this. The thought manifests as the word. The word manifests as the deed. The deed develops into habit, and habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its ways with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. The possibility of engaging the refuges and the precepts as part of our daily practice outside of a retreat setting. Maybe beginning our day chanting them to ourselves. Could be a powerful aspect of encouraging the purification of our thoughts, our words, and our actions in our daily life. There's a particular rendition of the precepts that was written by a woman named Stephanie Kaza, who for many years was a member of the Green Gulch Zen Farm. And I'd like to share her rendition of the refuges and precepts with you, because I think it's particularly relevant and really a good reminder in relationship to daily life in the larger world. And this is from Stephanie Kaza. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to kill. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not take what is not given. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not engage in abusive relationships. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not speak falsely or deceptively. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harm self or others through poisonous thought or substance. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to dwell on past errors. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow not to speak of self separate from others. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not possess any thing or form of life selfishly. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not harbor ill will toward any plant, animal, or human being. Knowing how deeply our lives intertwine, we vow to not abuse the great truth of the three treasures. The three treasures being the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. For me, as I'm sure for many of you, over the years of my practice in the simplicity of a retreat setting, I've been inspired and motivated to simplify my own life, to live my life in a way that serves, that supports the process of the purification of the heart and mind, which is very intimately related to the development of concentration and to the process of liberation. And sometimes this happens through the conscious intention to let go of particular habits of distraction. And as practice deepens, there's actually more and more often a letting go, a simplification that unfolds really quite naturally with no feeling at all of forcing anything. We more and more easily and naturally relinquish the habits and the distractions of our life that don't serve this awakening process that we've committed ourselves to. And it's really very often around quite ordinary, very mundane aspects of our life. So an example that I like to give that I know some of you have heard, it's still active for me to some degree, so I'm going to continue to give this example. There was a time when I would get into my car, I would automatically turn on the radio, the car radio. Every time I'd get into it, I'd do that. And at some point, I began to notice it as a distraction. And so I decided not to turn it on all the time. So I'd begin driving somewhere, and my hand would automatically begin to move towards the radio knob on the dashboard. The force of habit is incredibly strong. So very mindfully, I'd notice that happening. I'd feel it happening. And I'd very mindfully bring my hand back down. And at some point, I began to notice the thought to turn on the radio. And then the choice was available. It was really available to or not to. It doesn't happen very often, hardly ever anymore. But when I do, when it does start to happen, I notice before the thought, there's this impetus in me, an inclination to, it's actually an inclination to distract myself is how it feels, what it feels like. And I know enough about that now that it's about turning on the radio. So I go, oh, there it is again. Okay, not doing that. Or sometimes I choose, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to listen to the radio. I want to hear some music. Mostly I don't turn it on, though. There's improvement possible. So looking at another change in our simple and quiet space of retreat. During these almost 5 days now, there might have been some big days for you, maybe some big events for you. Maybe the big event of it's mealtime, preparing my meal, eating my food, washing my dishes, or not washing my dishes, letting them pile up in the sink, maybe. Well, what am I going to have? It's breakfast meal. What am I going to have for lunch? And thinking about that, that's a big deal. Could be a big deal. Or maybe tomorrow, what will I have for lunch tomorrow? How about the big deal of having a one-on-one practice meeting every day, every single day? Wow, that's a big deal. Might have been. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was. There's a little poem by a Japanese poet who's no longer alive, Nanao Sakaki. He was a wandering Japanese Buddhist poet who died, I think he died around 9 years, 9 or 10 years ago now. And this poem he calls A Big Day. Getting water at the spring. Carrying firewood. Chattering with a neighbor. The sun goes down. A big day. Many years ago, Nanao used to spend time up at the Lama Foundation, which is about 45 minutes north of Taos. And he'd show up at Lama with his small knapsack and a sleeping bag. And he'd stay there for a couple of days, stay overnight for a couple of days, and they were really always delighted to put him up. And then Nanao would head out to the mountains with just this, nothing more than what he'd arrived with. And he'd sometimes be gone for a few days or maybe a few weeks. And then he'd be back again at the Lama Foundation. A very dear friend of mine who was the coordinator up at the Lama Foundation during those years told me a story of one of these times when Nanao had come in for a day or two from the mountains. He was intending to go back out again. So he'd come in for a day or two, and he asked my friend and another person who was living at the Lama Foundation if they would like to come out to his camp for dinner in a few days. Well, my friend was thrilled. That had never been, that was so special. No one, he'd never done such an invitation before. So they were really excited about going out to have dinner with Nanao at his camp. So on the appointed day, at the appointed time, my friend and the other invitee found their way out to Nanao's camping spot, following his very careful directions. And when they got there, Nanao was there, but there wasn't any food ready, or there wasn't even any food in sight, no food in view. And he told them not to bring anything with them, that it wouldn't be necessary, that there, he said there was plenty of food, just come, you know. Well, my friend said they thought maybe they'd made a mistake, that this was the wrong day. But the Nanao was so welcoming and so delighted to see them. And he said heartily welcoming. And then he said, okay, now let's go out and find dinner. So my friend said that they walked and they picked and they dug various wild foods. They came back and built a fire and cooked what needed to be cooked and had an incredibly delicious dinner. She said they finally understood how Nanao could go out into the mountains for days or weeks at a time with almost nothing and come back strong, healthy, and very happy. Once someone in a practice meeting spoke about the simplicity of life on retreat as having a really good taste. So we taste it. We taste this good taste and we take it with us. And it wends its way into our life in many small and sometimes in big ways. Certainly life outside of retreat can be quite complex at times. Our home life, family life, our community life, our work life. And yet there are ways that we can let go of some of this complexity. And we often do this little by little by little as our practice deepens in and out of retreat. So we make choices in relationship to the work that we do. We make choices in the ways that we spend time with a partner, with family, with community members, with friends. We make choices in how we spend our free time. And in this pandemic time, being mostly at home, simplicity is being asked of us. And our time in retreat can really be an inspiration towards manifesting this in wholesome ways. We really truly do have the possibility of simplifying, at least to some degree, every aspect of our life. We have the possibility of expanding and deepening this good taste that we take with us from the simplicity of retreat life. And of course, there are some complex responsibilities and commitments that we must continue with in our life. The taste of simplicity in retreat has another very beneficial effect on our life outside of retreat. It affects and inspires the way that we expend our energy. What we put our energy towards, how we use our energy, even in the midst of complex activities, relationships, and various responsibilities. From our experience in retreat practice, we learn, we see, we come to know more and more clearly when we're off balance in the ways that we engage and use our energy, and when we're balanced, and we take this knowing into our life outside of retreat. As we naturally find ourselves letting go of old habits, old habituated, unskillful ways of being and doing, we find ourselves connecting with more skillful, more wholesome ways of being and doing. And we begin to feel more balance within ourselves and within our life as a whole. And we find then that we have more energy and more time available in our life to more directly and clearly for life to be our practice. So simplicity inwardly and outwardly in times of retreat. And as we connect to a larger world, simplicity being a really great support and a great protection here and there. A great support and a great protection actually everywhere along this step-by-step journey. So considering our whole life as our practice, how can we develop and deepen our practice in the midst of our everyday lives? I think this is really a very essential and important question. And of course, the essential ground of this is that we develop, that we integrate a clear, focused attention and mindful awareness based in kindness into all of the dimensions of our being, making our body, our speech, our actions, our thoughts, our feelings, our relationships, our work, our play, our creative endeavors, all part of our practice. And we can find many moments throughout our day when we can just simply bring our attention to the simplicity of the sensations of the breath, or the open spaciousness of the heart and mind. Really, in almost any circumstance, almost any activity. So from this perspective, it's really not very different from our practice in a retreat setting. In truth, all of the conditions, all of the relationships in our lives are wonderful mirrors for our practice. The joys, irritations, the annoyances and delights, the frustrations and the satisfactions, the likes and dislikes, all that we experience in life in retreat, because you experienced all of those things at some point during these 5 days to varying degrees. And all of these experiences that we experience outside of retreat, all of it are mirrors for our practice. Quite a number of years ago, when I was teaching over, spread out over a 10-year period, I didn't stay there. I just went back and forth on a yearly basis. I taught in Israel, and there was a woman in one of the retreats that I taught who had, long before I met her, had lived in a spiritual community in France that was guided by the philosopher and spiritual teacher Gurdjieff. And this woman told me a story that's really a wonderful mirror of a particular and difficult life situation at this community that was run by Gurdjieff, being the perfect practice. She said that in this community in France, there was an old man who was, she said he was a very difficult person, a really irascible fellow. And she said he was really messy, and he was pretty argumentative a lot of the time. And she said he wouldn't cooperate, he wouldn't help with things much at all. And he basically didn't get along with most of the people in the community much at all either. And she said no one liked him very much. And he himself didn't seem to like many of the people in the community either. And she told me that he tried for quite a long time to stay in the community, but that it was really difficult for him, as you can imagine, as well as for the other people in the community. And it was so difficult that she said he finally left and he went to Paris, because he couldn't stand it anymore. Well, Gurdjieff followed him to Paris, and he tried to convince this man to return to the community. But the man said no, he just couldn't do it. It was just too hard to be there. He couldn't do it. So Gurdjieff finally offered him a monthly stipend to come back to the community, which the man couldn't refuse because he was a very, very poor person. And so he did return. But when he arrived, she said everyone in the community was really, really surprised and kind of aghast. And they were even more surprised and aghast when they found out that this guy was being paid to be there, because they themselves actually had to pay to live in the community. And they started really complaining a lot, she said. Not happy at all. So Gurdjieff called a meeting, and she said he listened to everybody's complaints, and then he laughed, and he said, "This man is yeast for your bread. Without him, you would never learn about anger, irritability, patience, the heart of unconditional kindness and compassion. That's why you pay me, and I pay him." So the conditions of our lives, the people in our lives, are really all part of our practice. They're yeast for our bread, yeast for the purification of our heart and mind, yeast for our awakening, yeast for our liberation of heart and mind. There's one teaching among the 84,000 teachings that the Buddha is said to have offered. 84,000, can you imagine? And this is where the Buddha uses the metaphor of the four divine abidings, metta, karuna, compassion, mudita, appreciative joy, and upekkha, equanimity. With, in relationship to a mother, it's a metaphor for a mother who has four sons. Each of the sons, because of their particular personality and order in the family, represent each one of these, each one represents one of the divine abidings. In the way that they represent them, they call forth one of the divine abidings from the mother, from their mother. It's a really interesting teaching. Well, I only have three sons, but I have to say they have managed to be some of my strongest teachers in many different ways over the years. Those of you that have children know that. You could say the same. Those of you that don't have children are the children of parents, that your parents can be really powerful teachers as well. Our closest people can often be really some of our best teachers, just simply through them being who they are, what they need from us, and what they give to us. And what they show us. So in a very personal example, my two oldest sons, who are now 55 years old, and they are identical twins. And they continue to show me, they continue to teach me a relationship that I think is very rare. They're each other's best friend, truly best friend. And although when they were little boys, they would sometimes argue and fight with each other as children do. But over all of these years, and this is 55 years now, over all of these years, they've never talked about each other or to each other in negative or judgmental ways. And I find that astounding, amazing. They've never really, really never put each other down. No matter what one or the other is feeling, no matter what one or the other has done or not done, and how the other's life is going. And they're not each other's keeper. And I can honestly say, and it seems so amazing to me, that they've never been disrespectful or codependent with each other. I think it's a very rare kind of friendship, and I'm often in awe of it, and I learn from it every day in some way. It doesn't pop up every day, and I don't see them that much because they live far away, but we talk on the phone regularly, and I learn from it continuously. Every aspect of life is potentially a teaching. Every aspect of life has the potential to reveal the truth to us. And some words from the Buddha. As a bee seeks nectar from all kinds of flowers, seek teachings everywhere. Like a deer that finds a quiet place to graze, seek seclusion to digest all that you have gathered. And a poem. This is a poem that was translated from the Turkish by a poet named Edib Kuntsever. I don't think I'm probably pronouncing it properly, but that's how I'm reading the way it's spelled. And it was translated by Richard Tillinghast. And the poem is called Table. A man filled with the gladness of living put his keys on the table, put flowers in a copper bowl there. He put his eggs and milk on the table. He put there the light that came in through the window. Sound of a bicycle, sound of a spinning wheel, the softness of bread and weather he put there. On the table, the man put things that happened in his mind. What he wanted to do in life, he put that there. Those he loved, those he didn't love, the man put them on the table too. 3 times 3 makes 9. The man put 9 on the table. He was next to the window, next to the sky. He reached out and placed on the table endlessness. So many days he had wanted to drink a beer. He put on the table the pouring of that beer. He placed there his sleep and his wakefulness, his hunger and fullness he placed there. Now that's what I call a table. It didn't complain at all about the load. It kind of wobbled once or twice and then stood firm. The man kept piling things on. The key to the door, the linchpin for the wheel of the cart that turn by turn moves along this sacred noble path, is first and foremost a focused, concentrated attention that's well grounded in mindfulness and kindness. And as some of you have mentioned, and it's true, that there's some change in the depth and the sustaining quality of the focusing power of the mind that you've developed over these days. A change from how it is in a retreat such as this as we connect with a larger world. And it's true that there's some change in the depth and sustaining quality of mindfulness from how it's been in a retreat such as this as we connect with a larger world. And although the same degree and depth of concentration and mindfulness is not usually totally sustained outside of the retreat setting, the concentration and mindfulness capacities that you've developed, along with the multidimensional facets of understanding, of wisdom that have blossomed for each of you in a retreat such as this, all of this is a great support and a great protection as we connect to a larger world. There is a change, but we don't lose it. Mindfulness, concentration, clear discernment, and the continued blossoming of kindness and compassion, it's all always available to us. Many, many years ago now, at the end of a 2-month retreat with one of my Burmese teachers, Sayadaw Upandita, and 2 other Burmese monks, I had a brief conversation at the end of the retreat with one of the monks. And I asked him if there was any advice he might give me around taking practice into the whole of my life. And this was his response. It was a long time ago, but I've never forgotten it. He said, "You need to eat to stay alive and be healthy. You need to sleep to to stay alive and be healthy. You need to meditate to stay alive and be healthy. And that's all he said. Really good advice. And there are some particular ways that I and others have found, I think, to be quite helpful in bringing a simple and yet very direct and immediate concentrated mindful attention into our daily lives. One suggestion that came from a Dhamma teacher friend is that at the end of every hour of the day, just take 1 or 2 or maybe even 3 minutes to just stop and be still and simply connect with the breath at the anapana spot, the touching point in the nostril area or around that area. So if you do that, however long your waking day is, this could be 15 to 30 or more minutes of a very directly focused, mindful time, with each of these minutes actually having an effect on the moments that follow. So another way to carry our practice into our daily lives is to remember at moments during the day to, for instance, touch into the physical sensations through contact, meaning our feet on the ground, connecting with that. Our bottom touching the chair or the couch or the cushion. Our hands touching each other. Our arms touching the sides of our body. Our tongue touching the roof of our mouth, our lips touching together. Many possibilities. Mindfulness and concentration are immediately connected with and strengthened every single time we do this. And I think really the only hard thing about doing these teeny little brief meditation sessions is to remember to do them. That's the hard part, to remember to do them. And I know some people who put little notes to themselves around their home or in their workplace, sort of reminders to themselves to check in. So a note on the bathroom mirror saying breathe or breath, or a note on the bathroom mirror saying I am here. Maybe a stand-up note on your desk at home or at work, still breathing. Or a note saying, metta now. A number of years ago, when I was the resident teacher at the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, there was a fellow who was on staff who worked in the front office at IMS, and he had a little stand-up note on his desk that said, buttocks, to remind him to bring his attention to the touch points of his bottom on the chair every now and then. And it also brought laughs. Everybody who would look at it, we'd laugh, probably more than once. Eventually, he got tired of it, so he changed the note. But it was a great note for a while. The former director of the Forest Refuge, a number of years ago now, when I was teaching there on a very regular basis, the Forest Refuge being the long-term practice center at the Insight Meditation Society, in case some of you don't know that. So this former director, he had programmed his computer to sound the ring of a mindfulness bell every 45 minutes. And I found out about this because I was in a meeting with him. And all of a sudden there was the sound of a mindfulness bell and he stopped talking. In mid-sentence, he just stopped talking and he said, that's the mindfulness bell. We're taking time right now. So we stopped our meeting. We sat there for a couple of minutes silently together and then we proceeded with the meeting. And every 45 minutes he stopped wherever he was. And I mean, if he was in audible distance to hearing it, he just stopped. I thought that was really a wonderful idea. Walking meditation. So walking meditation can really be quite an important and powerful aspect of our practice in the midst of our daily life. It's quite an important aspect of continuing to connect with and strengthen the presence of concentration and mindfulness. Most of us walk at least a few miles, just going from place to place in our house, around our house. If we're going out to shop or we don't do too much of that these days, but still we're doing some things outside of the house. I think many of us walk at least a few miles going from place to place through a day, or maybe not through a day, but maybe through a week or through a few weeks these days. And we can make some of this walking a time of practice. Not just doing walking meditation, but our ordinary everyday walking around taking care of business. When I lived at IMS as the resident teacher for staff, my workroom and my living space were the same space. It was up on the second floor of the main building at the Insight Meditation Society. And because I did a lot of practice meetings, I had to meet with every staff member each week, and I had a lot of other meetings as well. I really didn't have time during the day to do any formal walking meditation. So at one point I decided that every time I would go up and down the stairs, it would be my walking practice. And I went up and down the stairs quite a number of times every day. And so I did this most days. And at one point, a staff member came in for his practice meeting with me, and he was obviously quite agitated. And with a fair amount of difficulty, he told me that he was upset because he said I was ignoring him. He said he felt abandoned by me. He said that whenever he passed me on the stairs, I wouldn't even look at him. And he was wondering if I was angry with him. And I told him that going up and down the stairs was my walking meditation time, and that I certainly had not abandoned him, and I was absolutely not angry with him at all. It's just that I was practicing as deeply as I could going up and down the stairs. Well, as soon as he heard this, his attitude completely changed, and he was happy for me, and he told me what a great idea it was. People may not always understand what you're up to when you integrate your practice in life in small ways, but do it anyways. Use your life wisely. And of course, it's so helpful to connect with others who practice. And I think a lot of you do. I don't know if all of you do that on a regular basis. We certainly can see and feel the benefit of this, as some of you have mentioned, in this online retreat setting, let alone a live face-to-face retreat setting. If you're not connected at least sometimes with a group, even just with a group of one or two, or maybe three others, and in these Zoom retreat connecting days or Zoom connection days, there are an enormous amount of opportunities to connect with others. Dharma opportunities. So if you aren't doing something like that, please check it out and connect, do something. The Buddha, in a conversation with Ananda, who was one of his chief disciples, he spoke about the tremendous importance of the connection with spiritual friends. The Venerable Ananda, speaking to the Buddha, said, "Half this holy life, O Lord, is good and noble friends, companionship with the good, association with the good." And the Buddha responded to Ananda by saying, "Don't say that, Ananda. It's the whole of this holy life, this friendship, companionship, and association with the good." Use your life wisely. Use your energy wisely. Let every moment, as much as possible, be a conscious intent to practice. Meditation is one of the great arts in life. Maybe perhaps even the greatest. It can take place anytime, anywhere, when we have the intention to live awake. As we move into the larger world, if we're patient, determined, and intent on our, in our practice, it's inevitable. It's inevitable that calm and tranquility and joy increase. It's inevitable that peace increases and that wisdom, understanding increases. It's inevitable that our ability to live a beneficial and compassionate life increases. Another little poem from Nanao Sakake. He said, if you have time to chatter, read books. If you have time to read, walk into the mountain, desert, and ocean. If you have time to walk, sing songs and dance. If you have time to dance, sit quietly, you happy, lucky idiot. So I'd like to close the talk this evening with first a poem by Native American poet Joy Harjo, and then from words from the about the Buddha from the Buddha. And this poem, Joy Harjo calls this poem Eagle Poem. To pray, you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon. To one whole voice that is you, and know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, can't know, except in moments steadily growing, and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like Eagle, that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky and wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in, knowing we are made of all this, and breathe, knowing that we are truly blessed because we were born and die soon within the true circle, within a true circle of motion, like Eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. And some words from the Buddha. Yogis, bhikkhus, practitioners, mindfulness with breathing, anapanasati, that one has developed and made much of, has great fruit and great benefit. Even I myself, before awakening, when not yet enlightened, while still a bodhisatta, a Buddha to be, lived in this dwelling, this way of life for the most part. When I lived mainly in this dwelling, the body was not stressed, the eyes were not strained, my mind was released from the corruptions, the cankers, the asavas, or hindrances, unwholesome states, through non-attachment. For this reason, should anyone wish, may my body not be stressed, may my eyes not be strained, may my mind be released from the unwholesome states through non-attachment, then that person ought to attend carefully in his or her mind to this mindfulness of breathing meditation. So let's sit quietly for just a moment or two. And thank you for listening to the Dhamma. And we'll close this time of Dhamma exploration, chanting the sharing of blessings together. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.